PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. This afternoon, in this portion of the program, we're going to talk about writer Alice Walker, author of novels, essays, short stories, and poetry. In 1983, she was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for The Color Purple. While controversial, the novel and the film adaptation have been hugely popular. The Color Purple, shows us relationships between African-American women and how these relationships have sustained African-American women in the face of racial and domestic oppression and violence. Our guest today is journalist Evelyn White. She has written a biography of Alice Walker, titled Alice Walker, A Life. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. As I mentioned, Evelyn White is a journalist. She is the author of Chain, Chain, Change for Black Women in Abusive Relationships and the Black Women's Health Book. Alice Walker, A Life is Evelyn White's third book. The biography is published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Evelyn White, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, tell us how it was that you decided you would write this biography, a biography of Alice Walker.
Well, I arrived to be a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle in the mid-1980s, which was just about the time that the film version of The Color Purple was released. And so I watched with a great bemusement as a rookie reporter. I watched all the controversy surrounding the release of the movie, which had inspired many people to read the novel. You know, not that many people read the novel, even though Alice was the first Black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in fiction for that work. So I watched the swirling controversy and just thought it was rather amazing that people were so incensed by what I thought was a very, very important piece of art, meaning both the novel and the movie. And then a few years later, when Alice began to generate a lot of controversy and ire about her work on female genital mutilation in the form of her novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, the documentary she did, Warrior Marks, and a companion book also titled Warrior Marks that was released around the time of that documentary, I just thought that there was nothing better that I could do with my training as a Black feminist journalist than to go back and revisit Alice Walker's journey as what I consider to be one of the trailblazing, you know, writers and activists of our time.
Yeah. And you went and saw her speak, and she drew some ire from a woman in the audience who had helped bring her to this event to speak at a university gathering. And Alice Walker stood and superbly handled the moment with a great deal of of grace. And you also decided, I think, at that moment that you saw in Alice Walker just something spectacular. And not that you hadn't seen it before, but this, I think, was the galvanizing moment for you, wasn't it?
Yes, I definitely agree with that. I rather pride myself as a journalist for often being on the scene, being a firsthand witness to an event or an exchange. I'm not one of these journalists who spends much time in the newsroom. And so I was actually there sitting in the front row at this gathering in outside of Boston, where after a very moving speech about possessing the secret of joy, during which Alice spoke very movingly about why she had chosen to write about female genital mutilation. She talked about committing herself to this issue for as long as it took to help spare one girl child on the planet from undergoing this procedure. And so it was a very, very poignant speech. And afterwards, Alice agreed to take a few questions at a reception. And the first person to raise her hand was a woman who identified herself as an official from this college. And she went on to say in so many words that, in her view, Alice's speech had been very offensive. And by that she meant that people, in her view, would be upset because Alice had used in context the words clitoris and vagina. And, of course, in speaking about female genital mutilation, it made perfect sense that such words would be used. But apparently this woman felt that Alice had offended people. And she went on to say that she feared that many people would withdraw funds that they had promised to this college. And essentially, she asked Alice to give her some advice as to how to handle these complaint calls that she expected. And so it was an extremely, in my witnessing of it, insulting, you know, moment. Mm-hmm. And to me, as an African-American woman, it sort of harkened back to this experience that many of us have of white people asking us to rescue them. And I felt as if this woman, who was white, was asking Alice to rescue her and had given no credence whatsoever to what Alice had said earlier about what it had cost her to do the work. And so there was a very, very deep, you know, silence that kind of shrouded the room. And Alice looked to me, you know, very wounded by this question. But then she rose up very tall and in a, you know, eloquent tour de force, basically told the woman that she should apprise the putative complaint callers that most of the people in the world were not wealthy or white, that most of the people in the world reflected the protagonists of possessing the secret of joy, meaning that they were poor, you know, women of color with improper shelter, with improper health care, with improper, you know, food, with not enough nurturing. She went on to say that people who might have been upset by her speech should read the entire novel so that they could really understand the urgent problems in the world. And then she went on to, in my view, really indicate how upset she was by the question by saying further that it had been her experience that many wealthy people were tight with their money, and so if there were people who did not wish to purchase her book, that they could buy it, that they could borrow it from any public library. Mm-hmm. And that effectively ended the reception. And having, you know, borne witness to that, I was really, really, really energized to go forward to ask Alice if she would permit me to write about her life, and she said yes.
Yeah, yeah. The book, your story really about Alice Walker begins and ends with Alice and the subject of love. You quote her at one point early in the book saying, "It is love that makes me look at what I can't stand. When you love deeply, you can stand to see a lot more." And at the end of the book, in the epilogue, again, you have her speaking of love and that it requires a lifetime of energy and dedication. Is there any one particular moment in her life that put her on the path to this kind of deep love, or is it the sum to date of all the moments of her life?
Well, I would say that it's a combination of both. I think in my examination of her life that it's very, very clear that Alice saw, and she's spoken quite movingly about this, she saw her mother as a model of love. A woman, a poor sharecropping woman who, of course, suffered, you know, extreme oppression and discrimination. And still, she managed to love everyone in this rural community in which Alice was raised, in which, you know, her mother was born and raised not far from where Alice was born. So we're talking about Putnam County in Georgia, which is about 70 miles outside of Atlanta. So here was Minnie Lou Walker, who had to chop cotton, who had to work as a maid, you know, for white people, but still she managed to exude love. She managed to grow incredible gardens. As Alice and family members said, that people would come from all over Georgia to look at Mrs. Walker's garden. And so Alice saw her mother, as she explained to me, as just filled with abundance and light and love and able to have openness in her heart to the white people who really didn't see her as an artist, who really didn't see her as this fountain of love. So Alice saw that model, you know, very, very early on, well, throughout her life. And then I think that when she was injured at age 8, you know, blinded mm-hmm. in her right eye by a BB gun, in a BB gun incident, Alice has spoken about how that incident made her more observant and opened within her a desire to understand and love in some ways other people that she saw around her who were also afflicted, even extending, you know, this sense of love and compassion, as she explained it to me, to ailing white people for which previous to this incident she had not harbored much love because of, you know, their inflictions upon her and other black people. So I think the example of her mother and then the way that the wounding of her eye made her more compassionate as opposed to, you know, hateful, I think has had a huge, huge, huge impact in creating this artist and activist who is, I think, you know, most would say that she consistently gives out nothing but love and hopefulness.
Yeah. Minnie Lou Walker was also a woman who would not cower before any man. She was a very courageous woman. She stood up for her family. I think that that also must have had a great impact on the life of Alice Walker.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. There's a story that I share in the book about one of the white landowners trying to insist that Alice's mother, who was the mother of 8 children, Alice is the youngest of 8, that Mrs. Walker send these black children into the cotton fields, you know, as soon as their fingers were strong enough to pick cotton. And Mrs. Walker stood, you know, very firm on the porch of this sharecropper's shack and said to this white landowner, you might have some black children somewhere, you know, but they don't live in this house. So don't you ever come here again telling me that my children don't need to go to school. And so Alice and all of her, you know, siblings were educated. Many of them ultimately left the Jim Crow South because there was so much resistance to black people being educated. But both her mother and also her father, who, you know, was instrumental in getting a better school for the children in Putnam County. He was also a fighter. So, yes, mm-hmm. both her parents were very, very, very firm in fighting for justice.
Yeah. Willie Lee Walker, let's talk just a little bit about him. We don't want to leave him out of the story here because I think he's a pretty remarkable man. And he witnessed the death of his mother when he was a youngster.
Yes, when he was 11, his mother had been having an affair, there's no other way to put it, with a man in the community. And this was, as Alice's siblings presented it to me, sort of a response to her husband, meaning Alice's paternal grandfather, who had these affairs. And so Kate Nelson Walker decided, as Alice's sister Ruth said, that two can play at this game. But she decided that she didn't want to continue, you know, this affair. I feel that, you know, she was guilt-ridden about it, so she decided to break it off. But the man had apparently fallen in love with her, and so one day, coming from an outing with Alice's father, Willie Lee Walker, Alice's grandmother, Kate Nelson Walker, was encountered, you know, by this man, her former paramour. And apparently, as the story goes, he claimed to just want to talk to her. But apparently he also had a pistol, and it's unclear as to whether he intended to kill her or the gun went off by accident. But the bottom line was that she was shot. And Alice's father, Willie Lee Walker, sat in this dusty country road, you know, for quite a while with his mother. Eventually, she was taken back to their, you know, cabin where they lived, but she died the next day. And so, yes, Alice's father witnessed the murder of his mother, and it had a huge impact on him as a man growing up, so, you know, sort of held his emotions in. And not very expressive, but at the same time, a very, very hard, you know, worker, mm-hmm. and very, very dedicated to, you know, equality.
Yeah. And maybe you can tell us the story of somebody remembering how Willie Lee Walker and Minnie Lou Walker, before she was Minnie Lou Walker, how they courted, how he caught her eye, so to speak.
Yes, as Alice's sister Ruth, who's a wonderful storyteller, Ruth Walker Hood, who lives in Atlanta, and she's just the consummate storyteller. Well, as she explained it to me, Minnie Lou and Willie Lee Walker would meet in church, you know, very, very common. You go to church and your Sunday go-to-meeting clothes. And he was quite taken with her because, as we've discussed previously, she was quite an independent, you know, woman. And so Willie Lee Walker would apparently wink at her in church. And Ruth said the winks were so hard that, you know, people could hear the clicks. And I found it very interesting. There's a parallel. If one looks closely at the movie The Color Purple, there's a scene during which Mister, who is, you know, played by Danny Glover, is winking at Nettie in church. And I think that came directly from, you know, the lore and the actual Walker family history.
Yeah, yeah. Willie Lee Walker and Minnie Lou Walker, these two people, had this large family. Their lives were not easy, as you describe it. You remember Langston Hughes' line, "Not a crystal stair."
Correct.
What were their ambitions? What were their dreams for their children?
Well, as the, you know, siblings explained to me, and I was very, very grateful and feel enormous gratitude that I was able, during the course of my writing and research nearly a decade, that I was able to meet and interview each and every one of Alice's siblings. I find this, you know, just incredibly wonderful, because now, you know, since the book has been published, three of Alice's siblings have since died. So I was able to meet and interview all of them. And basically they said that their parents wanted them to thrive to the best of their ability. But it's not surprising that given that their parents, you know, were really suffered the brunt of, you know, racial oppression in the Jim Crow South, that they didn't have very, very long and wide visions, you know, for their children. I think that they basically wanted them to survive the South, you know, to not end up, you know, hanging on a tree. Or in the case of the girls, Alice's two sisters, there are five boys and three girls in Alice's family, you know, originally. And so I think the Walkers hoped that their daughters would not end up in white folks' kitchens, and they hoped that their sons would not end up hanging, you know, off a magnolia tree. And they hoped for them to have, you know, good, clean, honest labor in whatever form that could come to them as blacks, you know, suffering Jim Crow oppression. Alice, born in 1944, you know, she was able to experience more of the gains of the civil rights movement and the opening of the civil rights movement than her siblings were. So I think she would say honestly, as they will, that they did not have the opportunities, born as they were, you know, in the 30s, they didn't have as many opportunities as Alice. So many of them left the South.
Yeah. Alice, though, she also had she seems like she always wanted to be a writer, but she also had other interests. She had at one point thought it would be interesting, it would be good work to become a scientist. She also loved the piano. And here, you know, readers, Evelyn, are going to be thinking, you know, what if she had had access to that chemistry set, or the cost of music lessons hadn't been prohibitive?
Exactly. Well, you know, that's the thing about oppression. One never knows what could have been. And so as Alice made, you know, very, very clear to me, she said paper and pen were inexpensive, you know, and available to her in a world where, because of segregation, she did not have access to the tools like microscopes and chemistry sets that intrigued her, you know, about science, as she explained to me, after the scar tissue from her eye was removed. She was injured when she was 8, and 6 years later when she was 14 in Boston, you know, not in segregated Georgia, but in Boston, the scar tissue was removed by a wonderful ophthalmologist who I also interviewed. And so Alice, from her personal example of being a beneficiary of the wonders of science, she became interested in science. But she went back to Georgia after this operation, where she went to a segregated high school that had very, you know, lax, you know, materials. And so she had to abandon the idea of being a scientist. She took piano lessons for a while, but the 50 cents per lesson was too expensive for her parents to pay, being people who earned never more than $250 a year. So, yes, the oppression, the economic oppression, the social injustice of the South at the time did impact Alice. But she went on, as I think she would say, you know, now, to what was probably, you know, her destiny, which is to become a writer and to rise to the highest heights, you know, as a writer.
Yeah. There's a great story early in the book about young Alice. I don't even know if she's walking yet, but she's pretending to read the Sears catalog, and she's got a stick, and she's pretending to write. So one wonders, you know, exactly, you know, if it wasn't her destiny that she become a writer.
Exactly, and I think sometimes the harsh adversity can push one in the immediate moment. It might seem unfair, you know, that adversity can push one unfairly in another direction. But I think in hindsight, one can see how the adversity can perhaps push one into one's real destiny. And I think in Alice's case, that I think we can safely say that her true destiny probably was to become a writer.
Mm-hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Evelyn White. She's the author of a biography of Alice Walker. It is titled Alice Walker, A Life. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, join the discussion with a question or a comment, you're invited to do so. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we're going to get right back to our interview here in just a moment. We're going to need to pause so our engineers can make a slight transition here from one transmitter to another. Okay, and we're back. That wasn't long at all. Evelyn White, during Alice Walker's childhood, she was a girl in the 1950s. The civil rights movement was building, and it was at 16 years of age that she first saw Dr. Martin Luther King on television. What did that mean to her?
Well, as she explained it to me, she'd come home from school, and her mother by then was working as a maid, and they would take some time out. By this time, it's important to understand that all of Alice's other siblings had left. You know, again, she's the baby of the family, the youngest of 8, so she's still there in Georgia. And she and her mother, on a black and white set that her mother had bought with some of her earnings as a maid, were watching the television. And there comes an image of Martin Luther King being arrested. And Alice said at that moment that, you know, she saw this black man standing up with dignity and a look of serenity on his face and resolve. And she decided then that she was going to stay in the South and fight for justice. She said that up until that time, she had wondered whether, if like her sibling, she would have to leave the South to flourish. But when she saw this image of Martin Luther King with the resolve, with the serenity, with the conviction on his face, that she decided that she would stay in the South, that the South was her homeland, that she would not be driven out of it by racist and segregationist and the Jim Crow system. And so she decided to stay, and she was admitted to Spelman College, where she won a scholarship, a partial scholarship, as a disabled student. I think that's important for people to understand, because Alice was and remains blind in her right eye. So she, her college was underwritten by this scholarship. I think they called it a rehabilitation scholarship. And so she stayed there. And so seeing Martin Luther King in that moment was pivotal in her decision to stay and fight.
Yeah. So she goes from Eatontown, Georgia, to
Eatonton,
to Atlanta, Georgia, and then it isn't long until she's traveling abroad.
Exactly. After her sophomore year at Spelman, she went to Helsinki. Her first trip abroad was to Finland for a gathering of a youth festival. So there she went, and it was there that she was first introduced, you know, to the Cuban Revolution, and was very much taken by the verve and spirit of the Cuban delegation. Also at this meeting in Helsinki, though she didn't meet them, were two women who became close to her later in life. Gloria Steinem was there, and also Angela Davis was there. So this was a meeting of activists, you know, in the late 1950s, coming together to do political theater and to read and, you know, discuss the political issues of the day. So that also had a very profound effect on her, and I think helped to shape Alice's world vision as both a writer and as an activist. I think it has been a point of confusion, if not ire, for many black Americans who've tried to have total claim to Alice and don't understand why she feels it necessary to be such a global, you know, activist. Mm-hmm. But I think that that early experience in going to Helsinki for the World Youth Festival was pivotal in helping her to see the connection between, you know, the universal struggles in many, many places.
She was also affected greatly by her professor at Spelman, who was there for a while, Howard Zinn.
Yes, Alice was very much affected by the activist, famed social historian Howard Zinn, who was chair of the political science department when Alice was at Spelman. And he was very, very instrumental in helping to organize the students at Spelman and other places in Atlanta. And because of his activism, the black male president at Spelman at the time fired Howard Zinn, claiming that he was an instigator. It was a time when there was, you know, those of the thinking that blacks should just be passive, and why force this issue? And Spelman was very much a place of that philosophy at that time. And so students like Alice were very much energized by an activist professor like Howard Zinn, but he was fired. And Alice was very dismayed by this. She wrote a letter to the editor of the Spelman paper that I quote in my book, in which she details in extreme eloquence and passion her feelings about Spelman firing Howard Zinn. And it was not long after they fired him that Alice left Spelman, feeling that the activist students really weren't supported there, and she transferred to Sarah Lawrence in Bronxville, New York.
Yeah. How did she choose Sarah Lawrence?
another professor, a white professor at Spelman by the name of Stoughton Lind. His mother, Helen Merrill Lind, was a philosophy professor at Sarah Lawrence. And so it was with the help of Stoughton Lind that Alice, who, as she said to me, had never heard of Sarah Lawrence, how would I have heard of Sarah Lawrence? But through the assistance of the professor whose mother taught at Sarah Lawrence, Alice was transferred there.
Yeah. What was her experience like there? As you mentioned, you know, how would she have known what Sarah Lawrence, you know, was, what kind of institution it was, where it was, that it existed?
Well, I think the one of the main points about, you know, the story is that you never know where your allies will come from. And while, you know, the civil rights struggle is often painted as this sort of very stark, you know, black and white issue, all the blacks were fighting for justice, most of the whites were not, that there were always righteous white people, you know, white people of conscience, of vision, you know, of integrity, who were trying to change the system for the better. And so Howard Zinn and Stoughton Lind and many, many other white activists, academics, were in the South at the time. And so Stoughton Lind, knowing that Sarah Lawrence was a place that had a great emphasis on the arts, that encouraged, you know, women, it was all women at the time, women with independent minds to go to school there. So he helped ease the path for Alice to get there. So she was happy to get there in a place where, as she said, her writing was taken seriously, her political views were listened to. At the same time, it was very, very dramatic for her to have gone from the comfort of the rural South, meaning a landscape she understood, even though it was one fraught with injustice, to a rather privileged all-white campus where there were women of, you know, from extremely wealthy families who had lived, you know, in fairly sheltered lives. As one white woman I interviewed said, you know, I was rich, white, northern, and had really no inkling of the kinds of things that Alice Walker had endured. But, you know, Alice got there, and she didn't, you know, guilt trip people. She basically helped them to understand how wealthy, you know, white women could contribute to the civil rights movement. Many of them that I interviewed talked about Alice being pivotal in helping them understand the greater, you know, world. And then Alice had the time and the opportunity and the mental and creative space to really engage in her work as a creative writer.
Yeah. You know, once she is, as you mentioned, you know, she's a person who grew up in the South, and that is where home is. And she and now all her siblings have left that home. And she would write about this for my sister Molly, for example, you know, leaving home and then coming home, you know, coming back. Was it difficult for her to move between, you know, the world of Sarah Lawrence and the world of rural Georgia?
No, I don't think so, because, of course, Alice couldn't escape, you know, the degradation of blacks in the South. She couldn't escape the injustice. She couldn't escape, you know, the stunted opportunities that she saw there. But at the same time, Alice greatly embraced the landscape and the majesty and the natural world of the South. And so I think that for her, going back was always a comfort because, A, she experienced black people fighting, you know, even though, you know, the system was harsh. She experienced her parents, her family, her community fighting, and then she was always embraced by the landscape. So my sense is that it was always and remains a comfort for Alice to return to the South. And so that pastoral landscape, she has always kept close ties to, find sustenance, you know, in it, and I think has, you know, gotten greater comfort from walking in a field in Georgia or Mississippi than from being in the, you know, most luxurious, you know, penthouse suite in a hotel in New York.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't after her graduation from Sarah Lawrence that she was back in the South in Mississippi.
Exactly. She had opportunities to stay in New York, to basically go anywhere she wanted to go, you know, after graduating from Sarah Lawrence. But, of course, the civil rights struggle, you know, continued. So she returned to Mississippi to fight in the movement there. And Mississippi was, you know, considered one of the, you know, most brutal places, you know, for the civil rights struggle. So she went to Mississippi to remain engaged, and it was while she was in Mississippi that she met Mel Leventhal, a committed Jewish civil rights attorney, and they fell in love and were eventually married and lived in Mississippi in the late 1960s as the first legally married interracial couple in the state.
Mm. How was their marriage seen by family and friends?
Well, Mel Leventhal wasn't the first white lover Alice had had. She had had a white boyfriend by the name of David DeMoss when she was at Spelman. He was an exchange student who had come from the North to spend a bit of time at Morehouse, and they became close at a mixer, as he explained to me, one night, and then kept this long-distance relationship going once he returned to the North. So it wasn't as if Alice's family had not experienced her before in an interracial relationship. As they all said to me, Alice has always done exactly what she wanted to do, you know, and so they learned to just be accepting of it. I think Mel's, it was explained to me, Mel's mother was not, you know, too happy about it. She said Shiva, you know, for him, meaning mourned him for dead in the Jewish tradition. But eventually she came around, and Mel's mother and Alice's mother became very, very good friends. And I understand that Mel's mother would send fancy steaks to Minnie Lou Walker down in Georgia, and Mrs. Walker would send her, you know, southern delicacies, pecans and, you know, beautiful flowers, and they got along well. And, of course, by the time Alice and Mel's daughter Rebecca was born, you know, this grandchild became a point of love for everyone, as children often do. Children can bridge that divide. So once Rebecca came along, everyone, you know, stepped up to love.
Yeah, yeah. In 1968, her first book was published. It was a book of poetry, Once. It was published and the publisher promoted it. Was that unusual?
Yes, it was extremely unusual at the time, and I think harkens back to, you know, the cosmic forces that Alice's career as a writer, and of course she worked hard, as all writers do, but I think that there were elements of it that were fated, and that when you step out and do your art and are committed to it, that often the universe will support you. So yes, this first book of poems that she wrote after, as she explained to me and as she's written about, after having an abortion, which was illegal at the time, all of these creative juices opened up, and she ended up writing a series of poems, which were essentially shepherded by Muriel Rukeyser, an activist poet who had been Alice's teacher at Sarah Lawrence. Muriel Rukeyser gave the poems to her agent, and the agent, over time, not too much time, arranged for these poems to be published. So as Alice has said, you know, quite forthrightly, I never really had to struggle, you know, to get my first book published. I had no designs, you know, for it was not my intention for it to be published. I simply wrote these poems. They poured out of me after me realizing that I would have my life back, you know, after this abortion. But she didn't advocate for the poems to be published. And I believe, you know, she was happy when she finally received the book. But as she said, I just wanted the poems to go out of my body.
Mm. And what about her first novel, The Third Life of Grange Copeland?
Well, after the poems were published by Harcourt in 1968, and they could see, you know, what sort of promise and thematic issues Alice was interested in, she went on to publish, you know, to write her first novel about a sharecropping family, you know, in the South.
Mm-hmm.
and the hardships they endured, and, you know, very much the oppression of women in this family. And so the same publisher published, you know, that book. I think understanding that at a time in the late 1960s, when a lot of the writing at that time from black authors was about Africa and urban strife and the sort of warrior queens and black princes, you know, this whole sort of revolutionary rhetoric, that Alice was writing about the rural South. So in that regard, her thematic interests were quite different from that of many of the other black writers who were being published at the time.
Hmm.
And so she stood out, you know, in that way.
Right. When did she begin to really build an audience? How soon after the publication of these two books, the first novel and the volume of poetry, did she really begin to find herself an audience?
Well, I would say that that there were always pockets of people who read Alice's work. And again, her work stood in stark contrast to what I, you know, categorize in my biography, the kind of death to whitey riffs of the era. Alice's stories in Love and Trouble, You Can't Keep a Good Woman Down. You know, those stories were very much rooted in a black female world kind of not caring whether or not, you know, the white man was dissing black people. So there were people who were always reading Alice's work and finding it different from the more sort of Mau Mau black power writing of, mm-hmm. of the era. But I think that it is, you know, honest to say that it was not until the early 1980s when Alice was put on the cover of Ms. Magazine, you know, just in advance of the release of The Color Purple, that a wider audience began to understand that there was this woman who had continued to write. You know, by the time The Color Purple was published, Alice had published four other books, you know, at least four other books. So I think it was in the early 1980s that she was poised to become the international figure that she became after she won the Pulitzer Prize for The Color Purple.
Yeah. That novel was quite controversial, and the film also controversial. As your publisher sums it up, it was considered by many to be sexually explicit, sacrilegious, exceedingly violent, biased toward lesbianism, denigrating to black men, and degrading to black people through its use of an embarrassing folk dialect. How did that controversy hit Alice Walker? Was she surprised by it?
I think that yes and no. I think by the time The Color Purple was published, that Alice was very much aware of the fact that she trafficked, you know, as a writer in issues that others considered, you know, taboo. Certainly in The Third Life of Grange Copeland, though, you know, not very many people had read, you know, that 1970 novel by the time The Color Purple mm-hmm. was published. But certainly in that book, she talked graphically about an abusive farmer, you know, who basically, you know, shoots, you know, his wife. In Meridian, you know, her novel from 1976, she wrote explicitly about interracial relationships during the civil rights era and during the Freedom Summers, and about black men having relationships with white women that caused, you know, all kind of fireworks, you know, down there, and black women feeling that their contributions were not being seen.
Mm.
And yes, her work had always been on some level incendiary
mm-hmm.
by those who were not, let's say, that interested in someone showing the whole story.
Mm. You know, I found the controversy really kind of perplexing. I had read prior to The Color Purple, I had read Their Eyes Were Watching God. I know why the caged bird sings. And I thought, well, you know, it fits for me. I mean, it is another wonderful novel. But there was the controversy.
Yes, and I think also as I, you know, tried my best to explain, you know, in the biography, there was also the context of the times, that The Color Purple was, you know, released, you know, right, you know, during the time of the beginning of the Reagan administration, when there were all of these political and economic, you know, changes that were seen as being, you know, very detrimental to minority communities. The book was released at the time of the child murders in Atlanta, you know, where eventually a black man was, you know, tried and convicted of killing, you know, all of these black children. So many people felt that the black community was under assault, you know, very, very pointedly in the early 1980s. Ronald Reagan was talking about the so-called welfare queens, and there was this sort of just constant barrage of negativity, or it was perceived to be negative attacks against the black community. And so for this novel to be released and for it to receive the acclaim that it did, for it to be taken under the wing of Hollywood to be made into a major, major, you know, film, many people saw, you know, as some sort of conspiracy against, you know, black America in general and black men in particular. And then, you know, my point of view is that part of it was also just simply sour grapes. How dare a black woman from Georgia, who had never been a part of the quote-unquote civil rights, you know, black arts establishment, how dare she, as opposed to someone else, you know, rise to fame and glory, you know? And that's just, you know, part of the mix, too, as I have seen it as Alice's biographer.
Yeah. It's a great story and really good reading here, Evelyn. Thank you so much for telling us Alice Walker's story both this afternoon here on the program and writing it in Alice Walker, A Life. I want to thank you very much. Evelyn White has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine, Alice Walker, A Life, published by W.W. Norton. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade, and Dave Dickey has those numbers for us, Dave.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was an interesting day on the Chicago Board of Trade ahead of tomorrow morning's USDA supply and demand and crop production reports, especially in the soybean pit, where we saw prices sharply higher this afternoon on short covering in a very thin trade as all eyes are beginning to focus on tomorrow's set of reports. Let's go ahead and get to the specifics of the Board of Trade today. We'll begin in the wheat pit with December having a high on the day of 305, a low of 301 and a quarter, settling at 303 down a quarter. March, a high of 315 and a half, a low of 312, settling 315 unchanged. May, a high of 320, a low of 317 and a half, settling 318 and a half down one. July, a high of 324 and a half, a low of 321 and a half, settling 322 and a quarter down one and a quarter. December corn, a high on the day of 206 and a quarter, a low of 204 and a quarter, settling at 204 and three quarters, up a quarter. March, a high of 216 and three quarters, a low of 214 and a half, settling 215 and a quarter unchanged. May, a high of 223 and three quarters, a low of 222, settling 222 and three quarters, up a half. July corn, a high of 229 and three quarters, a low of 228 and a quarter, settling 228 and three quarters, up a quarter. September, a high of 236, a low of 234, settling 234 and a half, unchanged. December, 2005 corn, a high of 243 and a quarter, a low of 241 and a half, settling 243, up three quarters. December Oats, a high of 145 and a quarter, a low of 141 and a half, settling 142 and three quarters, down 1.5. March, a high of 151 and a half, a low of 148 and a half, settling 148 and a half, settled on the low, down 2.5 on the day. And then that action in the soybean pit, November, a high of 540 and a half, a low of 529, settling 539, up 10.5. January, a high of 548 and a half, a low of 537 and a half, settling 547 and three quarters, up 9.5. March, a high of 554 and a half, a low of 554, settling 553 and three quarters, up 10. May, a high of 561, a low of 551, settling 560 and a half, up 9.75. July, a high of 568 and a half, a low of 558, settling 567 and a quarter, up 10.5. And August beans, a high of 566, a low of 566 across the board, no trade there today. October soybean meal, a high on the day of 161, a low of 156.80, settling 160.80, up 370. December, a high of 163.50, a low of 159.80, settling 163.30, up 340. And then the leader on the day, October oil, a high on the day of 20.95, a low of 20.38, settling 20.95, up 44. December, a high on the day of 21.02, a low of 20.50, settling 20.95, up 34 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where in the cattle, we've had a higher day today.
That's right, but lean hogs and February bellies finished lower today. Let's start with feeder cattle. October feeders, 113.70, the high 113.10, the low 113.47 and a half, the settlement that up 37 and a half. November, 112.20, the high 111.60, the low 112 even, the settlement that up 67 and a half. January, 108.95, the high 108.25, the low 108.90, the settlement that up 65. October live cattle, 86.52 and a half, the high 85.85, the low 86.40, the settlement that up 17 and a half. December, 89 even, the high, 88.30 the low, 88.67 and a half the settlement, that up 17 and a half. October lean hog, 72.45 the high, 71.85 the low, 72.10 the settlement, that down 130. December, 67.20 the high, 66.05 the low, 66.30 the settlement, that down 40. February lean hog, 66 even the high, 65.10 the low, 65.62 and a half the settlement, that down 7.5. And April, 64.15 the high, 63.35 the low, finishing at 63.75, down 12.5. And February bellies were down 90 cents today. The high 95.92 and a half, the low 95.22 and a half, the settlement 95.50, again that down 90. The Dow is up 28 points, the NASDAQ 8 higher, and the S&P 500 up 3.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Frank Butcher from London, UK, writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do radio stations play the most annoying song just as I leave the house? It stays in my mind all day. Is this deliberate? And how do they, A, know when I leave, and B, know what song will really rattle around my head?"
It's all about you, isn't it, Frank? Yeah. Many people suffer from the delusion that the radio is talking directly to them. Most of those are either gullible teenagers or schizophrenics. Well, the fact that in England, where you live, the radio station really is programmed by your personal habits,